You're listening to Just, stories about the people working to build thriving communities rooted in justice. I'm Jess Averhart, co-founder of Black Wall Street Homecoming.
And I'm Rob Shields, executive director of the ReCity Network.
All right, look, so here's why we're here. We're here to get proximate, we're here to listen, we're here to process, and we're here to help you process.
But here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to be preachy because we don't have all the answers, and we will never make you feel like an outsider.
Keeping with the theme of sharing, we always want to acknowledge the whole person, and that starts with our personal check-in.
Let's do it. All right. All right. All right.
We're back.
Hey, Jess.
Hey,
how are you? How are you, friend? Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Welcome back to you. Plugging along here.
I know we are. We're plugging along, and you need to catch up our listeners on your world travels, because I feel like every time we talk, Zoom makes it feel like you're in the room with me, but you're not. You're bouncing around the world these days. Tell us where what's the
about the world, but I am in South Carolina. Charleston.
South Carolina feels like the world at this point. Like, I get excited. I think I'll totally listen. I mean, I get excited to go check the mail these days. That's how my travel plans look. So South Carolina is a lot farther than my mailbox. So tell us what in the world's going on with you lately. Catch us up.
So I'm in Charleston, at least for another day, and then I'll be in Atlanta tomorrow on business. But in Charleston, I'm here to visit a friend. One of my best friend's daughters moved in, and I was helping them move and decided to, because we're in pandemic world, you know, you can work anywhere. So I decided to stay a couple of extra days and drive from Charleston to Atlanta. And your listeners can probably hear it in my voice. I have like some congestion. Well, what's interesting about this is that I'm here sort of to get some rest and relaxation. I woke up this morning at 3, congested, dry cough, you know, all the things are on the list
for COVID. All the things. So
I woke up and went and got a COVID test right before we got on air. This is why I was skinning it under the wire, because I just came back from the COVID test just to make sure, because I'm around my friends and in Atlanta, I'm going to be around some business partners, and we're doing a presentation to, like, I don't know, 30 of Douglas County's business leaders. And I don't want to be the one that, you know, gets them all sick. So said I should know within 30 minutes. So I literally will find out the results of this, I think, while we're on the call.
Wow. Okay.
I think it's just allergies. I'm pretty sure it's just allergies. It feels very allergy. Like, I have no fever and all that,
It's smart. I mean, it's smart. These days, this is what you got to do, right? You got to play it safe and make sure that you're thinking well of others, which I know that's what you're always putting others before yourself. So that does not surprise me. That's what you're doing. But
thank you for y'all's patience this morning and allow me to get kind of scoot in here right at the hour. Well, I'm excited about today's episode and really looking forward to this conversation. Been a fan of this work for a couple of years now. So I'm just excited to talk about it. I think it's going to be good. How are you, friend?
I'm good. Today is a neat day. It's my son's, Charlie. It's his sixth birthday. I don't know if any of our listeners have kids around that age, but you're picking the theme of the birthday based around the favorite movie at the time. So he's on a huge How to Train Your Dragons kick. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but
One and two. There's like two.
There's three of them. Oh, there's three.
Well, you know, my kid's 18, and if I've been watching the third one, we might want to question my choices in film. But I did see the first and second one.
Yeah, you never move past Disney movies, Jess. Come on. You're never too old, right? I'm still enjoying The Lion King and all those good ones. But no, it's a fun day. Got to, you know, we always wake up our kids celebrate birthdays with birthday donuts. So I was out making a donut run early this morning to make sure that he had it ready for him, and it's off to a good start. So I'm excited, but it's awesome. Even amidst the pandemic, right? You know, you're still celebrating milestones, and life is still moving forward. So it's cool. It's a cool level set.
Yeah. And birthday donuts are still the thing.
Still got to happen if you can make it happen. So I don't know how to transition from birthday donuts to to welcome our guests. So I'm just gonna do it. I might ask the first question of does our guest like donuts? Maybe that's what I'll do. That'll be the way that we pull this thing full circle. But excited for this conversation. I think this is, I say this a lot, but I think our listeners hopefully know that we mean it every time we say it, is that this is a really meaningful, important conversation. And I think really kicks us off to land the plane for season two, which is kind of hard to believe that we're even saying that in a really powerful way. I mean, these final episodes that we're going to be doing are really going to be very focused and interconnected. We've talked a lot of times about the importance of, if we're going to look forward with clarity, you know, if we're going to see clearly in 2020 and going into 2021, we've got to look back. We've got to look back at our history. And I think that's what today is going to be all about. It's about looking back so that we can look forward with clarity. And I can think of no one better to do that than our guest, Chris Everett, who is the director of a documentary called Wilmington on Fire. We're going to tell you a little bit more about the documentary here in a second. But before we do that, let's welcome Chris onto the podcast. Chris, are you on? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
I love it. All right. So I promised I would do this. Chris, do you like donuts? I've got to build a bridge between what we just talked about and our conversation.
Yeah, I love donuts, actually.
A fan of donuts? Okay. Do you have a particular kind or location, like franchise, that you're like particularly loyal to? Or are you just all things donuts all the time?
All things, really. I pretty much like the, you know, just the regular plain glazed.
Simple. I love it. So that hot sign on the Krispy Kreme goes up, right? Yeah. That's like the bat signal. I'm the same way. Definitely. Huge fan. Can't mess with the original, right? You can't get any better. So, well, we're excited to have you on, Chris, to join us. Thanks for carving out the time. I think especially with your North Carolina roots, you're joining us from Wilmington, which is the whole, you know, the history we're going to be diving into, which I think is especially meaningful, but also you live in Durham. And so worlds colliding here. We're a Durham-based, kind of Bull City-based podcast. And so to have you be a Durham resident, but joining us kind of on location from where this original documentary took place, I think is really powerful. And I think kind of is a walking example of what we're trying to get at for our listeners, is like being connected to place, having a relationship with place in your community and knowing its story and just being connected to the dirt, honestly. And I think that's what you're going to be able to do for our listeners. Just to frame up our conversation, just a little bit about Chris before we dive in to hear more about him and his story. Chris is a communications manager of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. He's a film director, producer, social media specialist, and a graphic artist from Laurinburg, North Carolina. So he's a Tar Heel native. He's a graduate of King's College in Charlotte with a degree in graphic design. Chris founded Speller Street Films in 2015, in which he produced and directed the award-winning documentary Wilmington on Fire. Through various grassroots marketing efforts, the film has gone on to win 4 awards and has been screened in 12 film festivals, which actually might even be more than 12 at this point. Chris is also working on part 2 of Wilmington on Fire, which is really excited to talk about. And I think this is why he's hailing from Wilmington for today's call. He's also consulted on various film festivals on social media strategies, community engagement, and programming. So Chris, we're excited to have you join us. Before we get into your story, just want to frame up a little bit about the documentary itself so that you can kind of take us into deeper waters on the backstory of how this documentary came to be. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Jess.
Yeah. And so for our listeners, what I'm going to do is just read sort of the synopsis. This film's been out for 5 years and continues to gain momentum, right? It's just as the world turns, so does this film in the hearts and minds of Americans as they continue to think about their place in history and our just historical context and foundation of what moments in time really mean. And so I'm going to read this. I think this will provide some helpful context as we go into our interview. So Wilmington on Fire is a feature-length documentary that chronicles the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. The Wilmington Massacre of 1898 was a bloody attack on the African-American community by a heavily armed white mob with the support of the North Carolina Democratic Party on November 10th, 1898, in the port of Wilmington, North Carolina. It was a coup d'etat. It was considered actually one of the only successful examples of a violent overthrow of an existing government and left countless numbers of African-Americans dead and exiled from the city. The event was the springboard for the white supremacy movement and Jim Crow segregation throughout the state of North Carolina and the American South. This incident has been barely mentioned and has been omitted from most history books. really wasn't until 2006, which if you do the calculation, that's 108 years later, after the North Carolina General Assembly published a report on it, that the tragedy became known to the general public. And this is why the arts are so important, is that when you bring creatives and filmmakers to the table, they can bring stories like this to life and make connections to what is happening today and provide you historical context and roots as to where that hatred begins, right? Where those sort of connections and ties start, and also the resiliency of a people. And so that is Wilmington on Fire. And Chris, we're so glad to have you here. I'm just delighted to learn from you and hear your story. I know you're in Wilmington with us. You're with us, but you're in Wilmington. I think you're filming Wilmington on Fire Chapter 2, right? And so I can't wait to hear a little bit more about that. Well, to set that foundation, again, thank you for being with us. Why don't you start with just telling us your story?
Yeah. Well, you know, my name is Christopher Everett, born and raised in a small town of Laurinburg, North Carolina. It's about 40 minutes from Fayetteville. You know, people, you know, familiar with Fort Bragg, you know, in Fayetteville. Laurinburg is about 40 minutes from there, 20 minutes from Lumberton, about an hour and a half from Wilmington, North Carolina as well. So, you know, just born and raised, you know, went to college in Charlotte, King's College, studied graphic arts. Before I picked up a camera, I was actually doing a lot of stuff in front of the camera. I was about 100 pounds lighter back in the day. And I used to do, a lot of acting and modeling for commercials and stuff like that. And that's what kind of led me down the path to do some film work. So doing a little stuff, you know, in New York and North Carolina, I decided to move to Georgia. Just didn't work out. And so I decided to start creating my own stories. And so I've always been interested in our history, our culture, especially Black history that's not really talked about in the mainstream. And so I kind of get that from my grandparents and my mom, because they always would make us, you know, read the encyclopedias. They also had like the old, ebony Black history book collection. It was like their type of encyclopedias, you know, for Black history. So we always, had to do like book reports. And then in the summer, me and my brother would go to New York with my stepfather at the time, his dad. And even though we would have a lot of fun in New York over the summer, he would always make us do a book report as well. And so I remember my first one was on Marcus Garvey. I had to get a book, and my brother had to do one on the Black Cowboys from back in the day. And so that's where I always kind of had my interest from, you know, just even as a young kid. You know, they always instill that, you know, in us to learn about our history, especially the history that's not really talked about.
Yeah.
And so when I decided to start my own film company in Georgia, I wanted to do something on the Wilmington Massacre. You know, I was kind of familiar with it, but, you know, I didn't really know the ins and outs, you know, fully. And so I said, you know what, let me see if someone actually did a film on it first. Someone did a documentary, I'll just do something else, you know. But I saw that no one actually did a feature length documentary on it. So I said, you know what, let me give it a shot. You know, this is an important story. And as I started researching and saw that it just wasn't something that was restricted to Wilmington, it was a whole statewide white supremacy movement. Even folks from my own hometown of Laurinburg, North Carolina, went and participated in the massacre of 1898 as well. So I said, you know what, this is a bigger story than just something that happened in Wilmington, North Carolina. You know, this was a whole statewide movement. So, you know, I need to take the initiative and really get this story out here the best way possible. Mm. You know, so that's how this whole thing kind of came together.
So Chris, as a producer and director, now, I mean, you've covered and leaned into hundreds of stories at this point, right? I mean, been involved with film festivals like the ones based here in Durham. How did you stumble on this story? Because you mentioned it yourself, that like this story, like many other acts of injustice in our country's history, is kind of intentionally not told, right? Like it's intentionally omitted from our history books. So how did you find it? And then why this documentary? What led you to say you wanted to tell this story specifically? And to create this documentary?
Well, it was, I was living in Atlanta, but I guess I got to go back when I was a kid. My uncle lived in Wilmington for a while, and he was an RN. So he traveled, he traveled to different cities. He would stay like 5 to 8 years at a time, go to a place. So he had left Durham and then came to Wilmington for 5 years. And he was a person that was into history as well. So anywhere he would move, he would kind of, you know, find out what happened in that town or dig up the history. He just was that type of person. And so when we would go visit him, like I said, Laurinburg was just only like an hour and a half from Wilmington. So we would see him probably like every other weekend. You know, me and my grandparents would go see him, and he would talk about the history there and talk about the 1898 massacre. So like I said, you know, I kind of knew about it a little bit just from hearing him talk about it as a kid. But as I got older and wanted to do a film on something, you know, I think they were showing something on TV about John Singleton's movie Rosewood, about the Rosewood massacre he did, I think, in like 1996, 97. And then also online, it was like they were talking about that film. Plus, they were talking about other massacres that has happened across the United States, like the Red Summer of 1919, Tulsa, you know, and other ones. And then they also did a feature thing on Wilmington. And I was like, wow. I'm like, this is what my uncle was talking about when I was a kid. And I said, you know what? I think it'd be pretty cool to do a documentary on this. You know, it's North Carolina history. It also has some involvement even in my hometown, the folks, some of the folks that were involved in it. And no one's actually done a documentary on it. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and do it. You know, I'm going to take the initiative. I'm going to start researching. So what I did was just I got a lot of books, started reaching out to different historians, authors, and also some certain direct descendants of the victims of the massacre as well. You know, some of the grandchildren and great grandchildren. And it was like everyone was waiting on an opportunity like this to get involved. You know, it's like everyone was kind of waiting on someone to do a project like this, because everyone I reached out to, they were just more than willing to help and get involved and just provided me with everything I needed, whether it was research, documents, you know, old archival material that was passed down, you know, from generations. Like I know one guy, his great great grandfather was a black police officer during the massacre. And, you know, after the massacre, they stripped all the black police officers from their titles, their jobs. But he didn't really know the story all the way. But he said, man, I wish I could have told you more stuff, because my people, they tried to tell me when I was a kid, but I just wouldn't pay attention. And, you know, now they're gone. And I was like, man, I should have sat down and listened. But I have some old photos of him, and you can use them in your project. And he's like one of the only people out there that has like these old photos of some of these black police officers back then, prior to the massacre of 1898. So like I said, you know, everyone was really waiting for this type of opportunity to come around to tell this story, you know, and tell it in the right way. You know, I just happened to have the initiative to move forward. Because a lot of people tried to make a film like this over the years, like the state of North Carolina. I think they tried to budget like $500,000 to do what I did, you know, to give a production company. It didn't get passed, you know, through the General Assembly, but they tried to make an effort to do that. Been several celebrities that have talked about doing something, you know, here and there, because, you know, Wilmington was a big film town, you know, with Screen Gem Studios. It was real big, like what Georgia's doing now. North Carolina was doing that, you know, the mid-90s to the early 2000s, you know, TV and film. And so a lot of people would, you know, I guess, hear those type of stories and find out about it, want to do something, but they never went through with it. But, you know, luckily, you know, we were able to do it, you know, and accomplish it.
This is so good. A lot of thoughts running through my mind, but one in particular before I get to the next question is this idea of the history that's passed down, you know, verbally. We tell these stories and they become like this thing of folklore or legend. And we almost are like, well, I hear this, but is it really true? Like, is it? And our history is so, can be so mushy, you know, unless it's someone like you. And I love that you said this, you took the initiative to sort of see the project through. You know, for my son, it becomes real. Like, they live in an environment, right? Everything's on their phone and they see stuff on YouTube. And so if it doesn't live in a digital space, it's almost hard for them. It's not in their books. They're not learning about it. Almost like this is legend. It's not true. So I really have done a service, I think, to generations to come to sort of solidify and make these the folklore reality so that we can live into that space in a real way and not through myth. So thank you for that. I appreciated just kind of walk through a bit of your process. For our filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, or people like me who are neither, but very curious. How do you bring a story like this, like you said, kind of buried? I mean, you're hunting and pecking for photographs. How do you bring that and do it justice, right? How do you bring it to life? I'm curious, how long did it take you? What was that research period? Like, I have a million questions around this, but like, if you can just lift the the hood a little bit and let us see what's under there around your process. That would be really cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when I decided to do the project, you know, first thing I did was I said, you know what, I need to come up with a title, you know, first, you know, because I like to come up with a title first, then build like an outline around it. So I had several titles. It was, I had some crazy stuff. I got like my whole notebook. I was, and then just caught me, and I kept looking at, you know, the burned down newspaper press, Alex Manley's newspaper press that was burned down. Mm. And that's really the prominent picture. You know, anytime anyone looks up the Wilmington Massacre of 1898, that photo comes up of the white mob in front of the burnt down newspaper building. And I said, you know, what about Wilmington on fire? And, you know, just because that was pretty much that's the main image of the Wilmington Massacre 1898, of the burning down of the newspaper, the black newspaper press. That's how I kind of came up with that name. And then just went to the drawing board of saying, you know what, how do I want to structure this thing? Because Wilmington on Fire was really my first documentary. I never made a documentary before that. So I got on YouTube, was looking up, you know, how to make a documentary. I got a whole bunch of books on how to do documentaries because I didn't know what I was doing. And so, you know, I just went on Amazon and got some books. And also I just started looking at documentaries even more. I know one film that's a great film that everyone should watch if you like Wilmington on Fire. It's a film called Banished by Marco Williams. Mm. Excellent film. And that really gave me the courage and the confidence to do Wilmington on Fire, because what he did with Banished, and it came out, I think, 2006. And what Banished was about, Marco Williams, he documented three different racial massacres in the Deep South. Like, I think it was like one in Arkansas and like two in Georgia. Things like Forsyth County, and I forgot the other two places. But he did something similar, documenting three different racial massacres that happened, you know, down south as well. And then with their situation was different. It wasn't a coup d'etat, but theirs was like true ethnic cleansing. Even though the massacre happened in Wilmington, you still had some black people that lived there, and you still have black people that live here today, even though it's not the big population it once was. But when he documented his three massacres, they totally just wiped out the black population. And like these places now, zero black population, you know, like, man. So, you know, seeing that, I was like, okay, you know, this brother did it. I'm gonna try to do it too. And so I just started looking at some of his other work as well. And then just started looking at documentaries in a new way. And then just started picking different pieces. You know, I watched some Ken Burns stuff and, you know, just watched Stanley Nelson, some of Spike's work, documentary work, and just starting to see what I like, what I didn't like, and how can I incorporate some of these elements into telling the story I want to tell about the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. So then I started researching, and anybody can also look this up too if they want to look up some of these documents. But, you know, the state of North Carolina did an official report back in 2008, and it's a 600-page document, the Wilmington Race Riot Commission report. So I read that whole thing, 600 pages. Wow. And also read a couple of books on the 1898 massacre as well. And then so from there on, I said, you know what, it's time to start getting some experts and reaching out to them to see if they're interested in being in this thing. So the first person I reached out to was a brother by the name of Larry Rennie Thomas. He's in the film, throughout the film. He's pretty much known in Wilmington as Mr. 1898 because he was really one of the only ones that's always been vocal on this, even before it kind of became a popular topic to talk about. And he's written several books on it, just the history of racism in Wilmington and those type of things. So when I reached out to him, he's the one that kind of guided me along and introduced me to people like Dr. Lewin Manley, Alex Manley's grandson, because his organization actually seeks out direct descendants of the victims of the 1898 massacre. And he's trying to help build a case for reparations as well. So he was one of the first people I reached out to. And from there on, you know, it just kind of spurned off into reaching out to folks on my own, like the lady who wrote the actual official state report for North Carolina, Larae Umfleet. I reached out to her. She wanted to get involved. Professor Sandy Darity for Duke University, he actually contributed to that report on the economic impact of the massacre. And so I reached out to him, and he provided that, you know, that context to the film also. And so after that, you know, we just started interviewing people on the phone, you know, going to see people. And then it was time to put the camera in front of everybody. So that process really took the shoot everything. I think the first thing we shot was in November 2011. And the last thing we shot was the summer of 2013. So it took a good, you know, couple years to shoot everything we needed. And this was all self-financed, you know, because I had got laid off from my job in Georgia and I had to move back to North Carolina. And I decided to leave Georgia and move to North Carolina and get this project going. And so I just took my savings and whatever unemployment I was getting and just made it happen. You know, I said, you know what, I'm going to go out on faith and just do this thing. You know, whatever happens, happens. You know, I just want to tell this story. No one cares about it. Oh, well, I know I tried to do my part, you know, in telling our history and preserving our history. And so it was a good 2 years of filming. Ran out of money because I forgot that you have to have post-production funds. So I needed about 15 grand to finish post. And out of the blue, an NBA player hits me up and gives me the post-production funds. It was crazy. Huh. David West, he's a retired NBA player now. You know, he played his last two seasons with the Golden State Warriors, you know, during their whole championship run. And he hit me up. His business manager hit me up because he wanted a DVD of the film. And I said, man, the film's not done, but when it's done, I'll let you know. And he said, well, how much do you need to get this thing done? And I said, well, I need, you know, such and such to finish it. He said, well, we might can help you out because I think this story is very important to be told. And I want a DVD also. So it was just a few months back and forth. He came to play the Charlotte team. Like Lauren is like an hour and a half from Charlotte. Went up, watched the game, chopped it up with him after the game. He said, man, I like what you're doing. I want to give you the funds to do this thing. You know, let's partner up to do this. And that's how we got it made, you know, and then we premiered it at Kukulores Film Festival. It's a big film festival in Wilmington. And we actually broke their attendance record. And we still hold the attendance record to this day for like the most attendance screening. I think we had like over 600 people in their venue. And we had like a 3-block line on the outside of people that couldn't get in. And it's been on ever since.
I love this story. This is so good.
I mean, having watched the film, Chris, I just think that when you mentioned earlier, look, I'm doing this. I'm not doing it for a particular number, although the numbers did come, right? And they did come. That wasn't your main drive. You obviously wanted as many people to engage with it. But I mean, one thing is clear that I'm sure you noticed as you filmed it was just, it was incredible. You could tell it was meaningful for the people who were filmed to give them a chance to tell their story. You could tell, it's almost like you're watching the healing process. Not that that's all it takes to heal, right? Which we'll be getting into over the next couple of episodes. Like, what does it mean to actually repair all this? How do we repair it? But you could tell it was almost like an act of restoration, like at the soul level, them being able to, because you're elevating stories and saying this matters, that this happened, and it matters, your story matters. And I think that repair is more than that, but it's also not less than that. And so I applaud you for, if nothing else, if only you, me, Jess, and David West saw the film, which thousands more have. I think that the gift you gave to the descendants, you know, who are impacted generationally by what happened now over 100 years ago is incredibly meaningful. And that comes through the screen so clearly. And so I'm grateful having watched it. It's a moving documentary. I'm hoping that every single listener that hears this will immediately go and watch the film, and we'll make sure we point to how they can do that. I want to flash forward a little bit. So this is a whole episode about what happened over 100 years ago, but I want to talk about the current moment for a second, right? So flash forward to present day. You know, this documentary is now going on, you know, 6 years old, but it feels just as relevant now, if not more relevant than it did, I would argue, you know, in 2015, not because the truths matter more than they did, but just because of the shift in national consciousness that we've seen, right? This awareness that has been primarily, I think, heightened by the pandemic and like the forced stillness that we're like, we've created this margin as a society that we haven't filled with a lot of other things. Like we've silenced the noise enough to listen, which I think is really hard to do pre-pandemic in this fast-paced 24/7 news cycle. So I think my question to you is kind of in the present moment, what makes this documentary so crucial for us as we reckon with our history of racial injustice, kind of collectively as a nation right now?
I would say, like I say, it's been going on, for some years that the film has been out, and it seems like this year has been like one of those years that a lot of people have really been engaged with the film and wanting to use the film as well for these type of discussions also. And I agree with you. It was the pandemic, because that pretty much, we couldn't focus on sports. We couldn't focus on a lot of the outside world activities, to kind of, turn away from the screen. Everybody was seeing what was going on, with police brutality and other situations that were going on in this country. And it kind of forced people to really see, what we've been talking about, since we've been here, on the soil in the United States. And also, you're starting to see things in mainstream media, like, Watchmen, of talking about, and dealing with the Tulsa massacre. And then, now Lovecraft Country as well, doing the same type of thing. And people like LeBron James, I think he's about to produce a documentary on Tulsa, so a lot of people are wanting to do these type of projects now. Back when I was doing it, no one really cared, so it's cool to see, that rise of consciousness, and especially in mainstream media, now really wanting to help elevate these stories even more. I'm loving it. I'm loving what I'm seeing. I'm loving how people are having these type of discussions and dialogues now. And I think why it's really relevant now, outside of the pandemic and the things of police brutality, but also with the elections that's going on, because that's really what made the Wilmington massacre an interesting situation, because it was all about stripping African Americans their rights to vote and to be in political power. That's really why the massacre happened, was because Wilmington at the time, was a very integrated society. And it was a very integrated political governance as well, where you had white and black politicians, African-Americans, were heavily involved in the political arena, not only in Wilmington, but through the state of North Carolina. And so now when you're seeing a lot of things in regards to voter suppression and things like that, and also just with the current political climate we're in right now, people, turn back to what happened in 1898. Like, I've did like 3 interviews over the past couple of months with the Washington Post. The History Channel did a brief thing on me as well. It's because of the elections, that are coming up. So anytime the elections and they, become a hot topic, people always talk about, what happened in 1898 in regards to politics. So, again, I'm loving what's going on. And also just what the film has really done for the city of Wilmington. And I think a lot of people forget about that. Like, the film has done so much for the city. People, whenever I come to town or I'm out filming or doing some things, people, if I'm wearing like a Wilmington on Fire shirt, people come up to me and say, man, we love the film. Even the Wilmington Police Department, they're using the film for their training for like new hires that the new recruits and stuff like that. And we're actually going to be filming some of that stuff soon in January, but they're using the film now to educate new hires, the history, of Wilmington, and try to, just have better community relations as well. And also a couple of big tech companies are starting to use the film in Wilmington, to help educate, their workers and employees and stuff like that about the history of Wilmington and their diversity initiatives. So you're starting to see those type of things. And also in schools in Wilmington, they're starting to teach it now and also use the film as a way to teach it, visually. These are things that I never thought would happen. I never thought none of this stuff would happen, but we're starting to see that change. We're doing it slowly, but it shows that, anybody can make a difference. Like I said, I was just a dude from Laurinburg, North Carolina. I wasn't connected to nobody in Hollywood. I didn't live in a big city. I just used the internet to my advantage and just put a film together and really just, work my butt off to get it out to as many people as possible. That's it.
We are. Yeah. So Rob knows I do a lot of work on like reinvention and this idea of like taking where you are in the next best version of yourself. I just love your story, because I love the idea of just taking all of your gifts and your intention and bringing it to life. It's just really cool. So for many reasons, I'm inspired by this, by your work. And so, we're on the Just podcast. So this is all about really thinking about the injustices of the world, right? But putting a lens on it so that we can help our listeners think about their place in making corrections, right? making those subtle corrections in their own lives and their families and communities that can right hundreds of years of wrongs. Mm. So when you think about, then I imagine that this answer will be personal for you. And I think that anybody who watches the film has a personal or visceral and personal reaction to this question. But for you, what was the greatest injustice of this story as a whole? What was the most compelling, if there is one thing?
I would say, you know, that this, it was a couple of things, actually. I think one was that this type of event, you know, happened to American citizens and nothing was done about it. Nothing was done to correct that wrong. And that led to other problems down the road. Like, for example, people not really knowing their history, their family history, because a lot of the direct descendants, a lot of them didn't even know what happened to their grandparents or great grandparents till they got older. Like Dr. Manley, for example, you know, his grandfather was Alex Manley, the guy whose newspaper building was destroyed during the massacre. He didn't know what really happened to his grandparents until he was like in his 50s, you know? So he said he always knew that his grandfather had a newspaper in Wilmington, because after his grandfather escaped from the massacre, they lived and just resettled like in Philadelphia. And he just never got into the newspaper business again and never even talked about that situation ever again. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until he saw his grandfather mentioned in someone's, I think it was John Hope Franklin's book years ago, that he mentioned the Wilmington Massacre somewhat in his book. And he saw him talk about his grandfather. And he said, hold on, what is this? You know, so he started talking to his aunts, who were small kids at the time during the massacre. They lived through it. And he came to Wilmington and talked to them about it and just started asking them questions. And they finally opened up to him and told him what happened. You know, and they were, you know, small kids. I think they were like 10 or 11 at the time when it happened. And that's when he found out. So I think that was another tragedy that people really didn't know, you know, their full history. You know, it was stripped from them. You know, it was based off of fear, because a lot of them, you know, feared that even though they moved away to, you know, a state, you know, thousands of miles away, they still had that fear that those folks were still going to do harm to them, you know, because even though they were up north, you know, still white supremacy was all over the country, you know, so just keeping that part of your family history hidden for so long was definitely a tragedy. I thought that was sad to me. And I would say third is just there really hasn't been full restitution, whether it's reparations or some type of restitution. It hasn't happened yet. And I think that's what really the city of Wilmington, folks in Wilmington across color lines, you know, white and black, all are saying there needs to be some type of restitution. Hmm. And especially the direct descendants of the victims, they definitely want restitution as well. I think those are the three things that really, really got me, you know, when I did this project.
Hmm. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's when you're saying nothing was done to make this right, to right this wrong, and that people were stripped of their stories, right? On top of everything else that was lost, loss of life, the loss of property, the loss of wealth, generational wealth, you know, that has had these profound ripple effects to present day. I just think that maybe the thing that rises to the surface as you're sharing is that whole idea of the dignity and the power of knowing where you came from,
right,
and you're knowing your own history and how much that was intentionally removed.
Also, I know one last thing as well that kind of shocked me too, because also just for the city of Wilmington as a whole, because back then, you know, Charlotte, Raleigh, those weren't the places to be. You know, Wilmington was the spot, you know, because it was very thriving and this massacre stunted the growth and the progress of the city. There's no telling what Wilmington would be right now. It might would be what Charlotte is right now if this stuff never happened. So I also look at it like that, like, man, because I come to Wilmington all the time. And I'm like, man, this city had so much potential, you know, prior to the 1898 massacre. There's no telling what it could have been. And also just the state of North Carolina as well, and just the American South, that, you know, this event kind of signaled this whole movement for white supremacy throughout the American South. And so it really shifted the whole country. You know, also, like I said, you know, this thing is bigger than just Wilmington, you know, North Carolina. It's really an American tragedy.
I think the film does a great job of providing that context, which is so important, I think, that you mentioned that, because, you know, I'm from New Bern, North Carolina. So I know more than most the significance of what a port city used to mean, because, you know, New Bern used to be the capital of North Carolina for a reason, because it's on the water. You didn't used to be able to have culturally significant places mm-hmm. that far inland, you know, that long ago. Now everything shifted. You have Raleigh, you have Charlotte. But I think your documentary, I can't remember the direct quote in there, but someone said it really poignantly near the end. We're talking about the devastation that happened as a result of this massacre really, really damaged the soul of the city.
Yeah.
Because you can't have something like this happen to half the population of a community. You're talking way more than just economic recovery. You're talking about soul recovery that is yet to happen. And so you're living with this damage, you know, this stain on your soul, not only for the people that received the damage, but the people who gave it, right? Because people who were inflicted it, you know, that stain stays with all of us, whoever was a part of it and whoever inherits the aftermath of it. And so I really am resonating what you're saying. And I think that's really helpful framing for people to see. They think about Wilmington today, but your documentary helps us think about what could have been if not for things like this. We'll never know. And I think that's just really helpful framing to kind of reimagine maybe a new story for cities like Wilmington that have such a difficult past that haven't really reckoned with it yet. Shifting gears a little bit as we move forward from this, you know, Chris, I know you're working on part two, chapter two, but staying with part one for a minute, what do you hope, since people can access part one right now, and I really hope they do, when they watch this film, what is your main hope that people would take away from this documentary and from this experience of leaning into this history in this way? You know, what change do you hope that this sparks? And I would say particularly for viewers who watch the film that call North Carolina home, because that's a majority of our audience, not exclusively. And we have people joining in from all across the country mm-hmm. that probably have their own histories to reckon with in all over the place. But I think even specifically for North Carolinians listening in, which is a bulk of our audience, like, what is your hope that they take away from watching this?
I would say, especially for, you know, North Carolina audience, is that, you know, this is our history. And also, I want this film, you know, to be an inspiration for folks to look into their own family history. You'll be surprised what you find, because after the massacre, you know, everyone just didn't, you know, go up north. You know, people went to Durham. You know, we know several folks who left Wilmington and went to Durham to start over. You know, people went all over through North Carolina if they couldn't go to New York and these other places. You know, some folks went to Durham, some folks went to Raleigh, Charlotte, you know, these other areas to start over. And you'll be surprised. I know even when we would go across the state to do screenings, I know it was one older gentleman in Goldsboro, for example. He came to a screening and spoke, you know, during the Q&A. And he said his great grandparents left during the massacre. You know, they fled the city. I think moved to Goldsboro, actually. And he said those stories were passed down. But you were never supposed to talk about it in public. And he said this was his first time even talking about, you know, his family history in public. And he said the film gave him the courage to do that, you know, because like I said, a lot of people, if they knew about this history, they rarely would talk about it in public because of fear, you know. But he was like, man, your film really gave me the courage to say, hey, this is OK to talk about. Nothing's going to happen. And so, you know, just things like that, just inspiring people. I want people to really take that away, to really that you don't have to be afraid, you know, for one. And then also, you know, start learning about your own history. You know, you'd be surprised what's in your town. It doesn't matter how big or small the community you're at. There are some interesting stories. There's some interesting history right there. Even where I'm from in Little Laurinburg, you know, we have a lot of history. So, you know, we have to know, you know, our history, not only just to know the history, but learn from the mistakes we made in the past also. Like Wilmington was a prime example of something that we should still strive to be, of an integrated society. You know, everyone working together for the betterment of everyone. You know, that's the positive. You know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the film, to show people that we actually did this, you know, coming out of Reconstruction, you know, after the end of slavery. And we have to come back to that again if we want to move forward as a country, and we can do it. We have the example, but we can't fall for certain tricks like we did in the past with this whole division tactic of white supremacy going in there and destroying that. You know, we can't let that happen, you know, again. if we're definitely trying to move forward as a country and heal from a lot of these past events. And so really, those are the things I want people to take away from it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good. You gave us some show up moments. So this is actually the moment in our, as we sort of land the plane, right? We ask our listeners to do something, to be actively participating in this podcast in some way after they're finished listening to it. And so you've already given one, which was get comfortable and familiar with your own story, learn your background, understand your story so that you can tell it. Obviously, I'm going to give one, which is to watch the film. If you haven't watched the film, watch the film. And it's on Amazon. I mean, you can just get it on Amazon Prime very quickly or on online. I mean, it's just very accessible. So just do that. Google it and figure out how you want to watch it. What else would you recommend for our listeners as they listen to this and you go into chapter two, which I've read a little bit about this work around chapter two over the summer. I read an article about kind of the impetus for this, but maybe this is an opportunity to set that up for our listeners as well. And if there's anything else that you want to share that you think our listeners could do to actively put this podcast and what they learned to practice.
Well, I would say that, I would love, for your listeners, I'll just reiterate, vote, one thing, because that's the spirit, that's the whole spirit of 1898. It was folks exercising their right to vote and also taking advantage of when they got in political office as well. So it's twofold. I want people to really go out and vote responsibly, research your candidates. And, I'm not telling folks to vote Republican or Democrat. It's really what's your interest, what's best for your family, your community, and what you really want out of a candidate, locally or nationally. So I think that's one. Also, the responsibility of the politician, and that's what folks did in Wilmington. They really felt it was their responsibility to make everything fair and balanced, regardless of race. And so the politicians that are listening, that's your responsibility. If you watch this film, I want them to take that responsibility of what they did in 1898 is to make it fair and balanced for everyone, regardless if you had money, if you're white, black, man or woman, that's what you need to do. And those are my things, the people that I want, your audience to really take away with this as well. But the follow up with your thing about Wilmington on Fire Chapter 2, it's really about taking the story to that next level, because whenever I would show the film outside of Wilmington, especially, we've been all over with this thing, LA, Detroit, all over North Carolina, all over the country. And the thing that always would bother me is that people would make it seem like no one was really doing anything in Wilmington. Like they just let this happen and over 100 years later and, this is just, why aren't people doing anything? I'm like, that's not true. There's some people doing some amazing things that are really trying to bring this city of Wilmington, North Carolina, back whole again and trying to bring it back to that 1897, the spirit of 1897. And so I said, I need to do a film on that to really close out the story fully. We know the history. Now let's talk about the present in Wilmington and how what they're trying to do in Wilmington, they're trying to get back to that model of in 1897 of this fusion type of movement. And so that's what's happening in Wilmington right now. You're starting to have like a resurgence of the fusion movement. Again, it's small, but it's trying to happen where you have white and black folks working together in unison, trying to bring this city back to what it once was. And I was like, I think this is important to document. And I think it's an important part of the story of just showing the resiliency of this city and of this community that, even though this happened, we're not going to, stay down, without a fight. And we got to do it for our ancestors as well, to keep their spirit and legacy alive. And we owe it to them. And that's really why I wanted to do this second part. And it's going well so far. Hopefully COVID doesn't get worse or whatever. We can premiere it next November. And do the same thing we did with the first one, go all over the state with it, all over the country with it, and just continue to show people, the history and the impact of this story. Mm.
Chris, we appreciate you. You are a gifted storyteller. The documentary is such a significant piece that is a must watch for our listeners. So anyone that is, you've made it this far, season two of the Just podcast, you're in this because you want to lean in with us to figure out what does it look like to build more just communities where everybody can flourish. And I love what you said. We don't have to act as if that is truly an aspirational idea, because you can look back at examples like Wilmington and see that we've had glimpses of what could be that were attacked, right? But we have, it's not that this is just, you know, something that you say and you hope for, but this is something that we actually have a proven track record of a roadmap of how to accomplish these things, and to watch how those things are, you know, how to be on guard against how people are going to try and fight against that as a roadmap for the future. And so anyone that's listening that's passionate about justice, I'd say whether you're here in North Carolina, Durham, Wilmington, the South, you name it, there is something to lean in and learn here. And so I just appreciate you and the work that you put in to give this gift to the community of Wilmington, to the state of North Carolina, really to the world. Hats off to you, man. We're looking forward. Can't wait for chapter two, and just wishing you all the best as you wrap. I don't think Jess and I probably should be your first call if you need that next big check. I think you probably need to stick with the MBA route, I would imagine. but whatever we can do other than, you know, writing that MBA salary check to get you across the finish line, man, you just say the word, because we're huge fans and supporters of what you're doing.
Cool. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And also, you know, I have another interesting story that I'm almost done with. It's a project I started right after I finished the first Wilmington on Fire. It's a martial arts documentary, actually. It's very different.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yes, I would say so. Kind of a 180 there, right?
Yeah, you know, it's called Grandmaster. I'm about 80% done with it. And also, I just got accepted into a huge documentary fellowship lab as well. Mm. And that announcement is going to be made like publicly next week. Mm. They're going to send out a press release. So for that project. And the film is called Grandmaster, and it's about Grandmaster Vic Moore. He was like one of the first professional black karate champions in the United States, and he's still around. Mm. You know, he was a champion and a pioneer in the sport of karate when karate first became a professional sport in the 60s. Mm. You know, and also his teacher was the guy who actually brought karate to the United States, Robert Trias. He brought it like to the United States in like the late 40s and opened up one of the first karate schools in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. And so that was his teacher. And, you know, so the film is really about, you know, not only his history and his impact to the sport of karate, being an African-American man, but also, you know, what he's been trying to leave behind to this next generation of fighters, you know. So we've been documenting two of his top students as well over the past 3 to 4 years. And it's a cool film. You know, it's very cool. And he also he lives here in North Carolina now, you know, so he's been in North Carolina for about 20 years. He's originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, but he moved to North Carolina in the 80s. And so, you know, he's here now still teaching and everything. So,
wow.
I love this. You're doing some important work, friend.
Keep telling those stories, man. That's right.
Yes. This is good. Really good. Thank you for sharing that last piece. I wrote it down. I'm going to send this, text it to my kid.
Yeah, I'll send you the trailer. I'll email you guys the trailer if you want to see it.
Perfect. Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah, we can add it to show notes. That's cool. Perfect.
Cool. I love it. Yeah. Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate you taking the time, man.
Oh, what a great guest.
Seriously.
He's just all the things. I mean, he's doing good work, and I don't know. I love it. If I had to time you, what were the quick things that you're just like, woof, that was so powerful.
Yeah.
Those highlights.
Honestly, I think two things. One is that this concept, which I think you have to be careful with in the nonprofit space, of like only speaking aspirationally as if there aren't examples. Honestly, I think I went into this conversation just thinking it was all bad. Like, we're just going to talk about something terrible that happened, and that's it. And I think you kind of take a deficit mindset almost into like projecting that Wilmington was all bad. That's not true. The reason this happened was because of the good that was happening, because people were linking arms across lines of race. In 1898, this was happening. Like, political coalitions, multiracial coalitions of people getting stuff done and like looking out for the benefit of the flourishing of all people in the community. That was why the massacre happened, was because of the power dynamic was being truly shared. And like, I just was, it helped recenter my framing for this whole story of like, you need to lean into this, not just to look at the injustice, but to look at the roadmap to building just communities was also in this story. And I think that to me is probably my biggest takeaway. And also this idea that injustice isn't just out there. It's in our own backyards, because most of the people listening to this aren't going to be from Wilmington, aren't living there now. But that doesn't mean that this is not relevant to you, our listeners. Like, it is in your own backyard. You need to look at start with your own family history. And just Chris's words, you'll be surprised what you find.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that. I love that roadmap, building the roadmap to justice. Yeah, it was cool. I also felt like much of my takeaway around the film is just this trauma for like an entire community to have such incredible trauma that never got addressed over 100 years and then continued to filter like through sand through every generation that came through that family, right? And so again, not to be deficit mindset, but I guess it's just another example, I think, for our listeners to just be reminded that, you know, when we talk about race and we talk about anti-racist spaces and we're talking about righting injustices, there's a reason we talk about that, because the trauma around a people that are neighbors and Americans versus the juxtaposing that with somebody who lives next door who doesn't have a historical trauma set like that. It's really important for us to remember that this is a real physical manifestation of things like a Wilmington on fire, of an 1898 coup d'etat that murdered people in the streets and ran others out on train. I mean, just imagine that in your own family or your own community, that happening to you. And that happened right here in America, in Wilmington.
Yeah.
And those families still live here and have never, and until recently, had not been seen.
No.
And I think that we have to just acknowledge some of that. And that's how I was feeling as he was talking it through. I love this chapter two piece, because I think that that brings to life again, resiliency of a community, a resiliency of a people, the strength of a people, white and black, that can acknowledge this wrong and say, where do we go from here? And how could we replicate the 1897 spirit? He called it the fusion movement. And so I thought that was a really great place to end, but it's given me a lot of food for thought. It's just, again, one more piece in this puzzle of why it's important that we have the Just Podcast and why it's important that we talk about these stories, because it's real.
Yeah.
It's real.
You bring up this juxtaposition of two realities that are, I think, true at the same time, is that, you know, clearly this documentary shows you that trauma compounds over time, right? Like this idea that, and I think Watchmen, he alluded to Watchmen, which, you know, that as the power of art and stories to tell our history in a way that we can access. And like, I think Watchmen even does that beautifully in the way that they tackle generationally inherited trauma, like as a mental health issue of like, man, I'm inheriting the weight and the trauma of my ancestors, and I carry that on my shoulders. That does it better than I think I've ever seen. And I think you're so right. Like when you hear these stories in this documentary, you're just face to face with just the aftermath still, like the ripples of 123 years ago, right? Still being felt today in the present moment, because these things have never been made right. And you don't just bury it. You can try to bury the story. You can't bury the trauma. Another thing that I think will set up our next episode, right, when we're starting to actually ask the question, how do we repair this? How do we fix this? To talk about making restitution and repair, this idea that trauma compounds, but so does wealth. And I think that for me, I'm left with the question of like, we need to look at both sides of a story like this, of what was lost, but also who benefited from the loss. Like, because he mentioned Alex Manley's burnt newspaper as like press and like the building as the most famous shot from 1898. But, you know, the documentary gets into this, like the contemporary of his newspaper was the News and Observer. Holy smokes, Jess, like the News and Observer, people, like, you know, the News and Observer, it is the show. And guess what? In 1898, it had a competitor. And that story of like, man, when the black newspaper gets burned to the ground, yeah, it's a loss it's a terrible loss, but also it's a gain for the competition. And you kind of have to talk about the realities of like
right.
trauma compounding negatively and wealth compounding positively for people as a result of the same cataclysmic injustice.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I think there's a lot of for our listeners to dig in on this and to just, again, I think thought exercises are important. We talked about this a bunch. And this is one, I mean, you just laid out several ways in which to view this film and to think about, especially if you live in North Carolina, but not exclusively, how this translates over to you even today, what that impact looks like even today with how you engage with media. And so I think you're right on it. And we've now given our listeners how many show up moments?
Enough to do at least 7 of them. Yeah. Maybe just start by watching the film. Watch the film, engage with it. And then I think from there, it's like we're all trying to figure out what does it look like to lean into our own stories. And I don't think there's a clean roadmap for that, but I don't think our listeners really need that also. Like you know what to do. We all can find out. You have those conversations. I mean, Chris provided that it's going to take work. Clearly you saw that. Like he had to work his butt off to discover and put this story together. This is not going to be easy work. So to do that accounting, do that assessment on the front end that this is going to, it's going to take effort because these stories have been intentionally buried and it's going to take some time to dig them up, but I think will be worth the journey for sure.
So good. Thank you. Hey, can I tell our listeners who I told I would know my COVID test in 30 minutes?
Yes. We're, drum roll, please. I hope it's only good news, but
it is good news. Okay. I'm around for another negative day.
There we go. There we go. Wow. Real time. They weren't kidding. They weren't kidding when they said 30 minutes.
Yeah. I don't want anybody thinking like lingering, like, oh, I have to wait till next week to see if Jess is sick. So no, I'm not sick. I mean, I am definitely allergies or whatever is happening congested wise, but it's not COVID. Thank goodness.
Oh man. That's grateful. Anyway. Grateful to hear.
Thank you.
Well, now you can just fully enjoy all that Charleston has to offer, Jess, until you get back to the Bull City. So
I am going to do that. I'm looking forward to coming home, but while I'm here, I'm going to eat some amazing food and take a walk downtown and take in that history. Some history, right?
You talk about some history. Holy smokes. Yeah. We should have just, that's a whole nother. You're right. That's a whole nother episode. That's going to have to be a season 3 right there.
Season 3.
That might season be all three of season 3.
On site. Yeah. We'll have to come back here.
Holy smokes. Okay. All right, friend. All right. Until next time, looking forward to continuing the conversation. Be good.
Thanks so much for listening to Just. In the spirit of sharing, if you like what you've heard, tell a friend about the show and give us a 5-star rating and review.
Many thanks to DJ P-Dog and producer Low Key for producing the music for our show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wilmington is just one instance of upwards of about 100 of these massacres in the United States. The case for reparations is based upon slavery, but also upon nearly a century of legal segregation in the United States. The average black household has a net worth that is approximately $850,000 less than the average white household.